Today on Against the Grain, we expect to find strawberries in the supermarket all year round. But geographer Julie Guthman argues that for strawberries to be produced throughout the year, which used to be harvested a few weeks in spring, has required an enormous marshalling of chemical fumigants, pesticides, workers' labor, and land. And that effort is now fracturing. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Strawberries are the most popular berry in the United States and one of the largest crops produced in California. They conjure up sweet flavor and nutrition, but should also be associated in our minds with backbreaking work, labor exploitation, climate disruption, and the massive use of fumigants to hamper soil-based pathogens. And these fumigants, as the latest book by Julie Guthman shows, have a fascinating history, starting with World War I, and an uncertain future. In her book, Wilted, Pathogens, Chemicals, and the Fragile Future of the Strawberry Industry, Guthman examines the plight of strawberry growers, beset by problems of their own making, as well as larger structural issues involving land. Guthman teaches social sciences at UC Santa Cruz and writes frequently about food politics. Her other books include Agrarian Dreams and Weighing In, and she joins me now. Julie, we take it for granted that we can get year-round strawberries. Why shouldn't we?
Well, the availability of year-round strawberries was a phenomenon of a lot of work to make them available. And a lot of ingredients went into year-round strawberries, including chemical fumigation, including plant breeding, and the plant breeding that took advantage of the various climatic zones in California. So, most places where strawberries are grown has a small season, maybe a three-week season in the spring. In California, we see strawberries nearly year-round. They're not always from the same area, but in some areas in California, they can harvest strawberries up to 9 months of the year.
So you're saying, in effect, that's artificial. That's because of the marshalling of all sorts of things, which we'll be discussing to make this possible.
You got it.
We'll get into great depth about how the strawberry industry has changed in California.
Sure.
But let's start with the origins of the strawberry industry in the 19th century. How did it benefit from the advantages that you flagged that made this kind of production possible?
Okay, well, in the late part of the 19th century, strawberries was an experimental crop. There was strawberries grown in patches all over the state of California, but the beginnings of the industry were in the Pajaro Valley, which bridges Santa Cruz and Monterey County, and it's still kind of the center of the industry. And a lot of growers there had apple orchards, and they planted strawberries in the rows in between and had some success. But there were, small patches, maybe an acre. I don't even think they were that large. And one of the issues is there wasn't much of a market for strawberries because the strawberries then weren't bred to ship so far. And so who was going to buy these strawberries? And Pajaro Valley was not an urban center. So one of the things that first enabled some growth was a railroad that went from Pajaro Valley into San Francisco. And once they started shipping strawberries to San Francisco, they were able to expand some acreage. But it was still kind of a specialty crop and a delight for San Francisco consumers, but nothing that anybody expected to have year-round. But it continued to grow in the 1910s and 1920s. And then what happened is growers started to experience all sorts of evidence of disease in their fields, all sorts of blights. What happened is this small strawberry industry called on the University of California to help out. And they went first to the Department of Plant Pathology at University of California, Berkeley. And the plant pathologist tried to identify what was going on, what kind of diseases existed, and they discovered that some of these diseases were caused by fungal pathogens. Verticillium dahliae was one of the first fungi discovered to be causing disease, and what would happen is the fungi would colonize the root of the strawberry plant, and the plant would uptake it and to kind of protect itself, and that it would clog the vessels of the plant, and the plant would wilt and die because it couldn't get enough water and nutrients. So with Verticillium dahliae identified, the university started working on efforts to control it. And they recommended all sorts of things to growers, none of which were particularly effective. They also started doing a plant breeding program. One of the priorities was to develop disease-resistant varieties. And they did that. In the mid-1940s, they released 5 university varieties. That was like kind of the beginning of this strawberry breeding program from the University of California that still exists today and serves strawberries internationally. I've met people from New Zealand that buy strawberries from California. But none of this was really working, and they were also breeding for productivity, and the growers loved to have more productive varieties. And so the university kept on experimenting with ways to control these diseases, and then they landed on fumigation. And the first chemical they tried fumigating with was chlorpicrin, or the first chemical that was successful was chlorpicrin, which is a tear gas. It was used in World War I as a gas. It's not a lethal gas, but what would happen is enemy soldiers could release the gas, and because chlorpicrin causes people to vomit and tear up, they would remove their gas mask and be exposed to the full lethal spectrum of gases. So anyways, that was the first fumigant used in the strawberry fields. And to be really clear here, a fumigant is it's something that's applied before you plant any strawberries. You inject it into the ground, and it would help control those diseases. But chlorpicrin was expensive, a little bit hard to obtain. It worked pretty well. And then they tried combining it with methyl bromide that was first a fire retardant. And they found that the combination worked really, really well. And methyl bromide has a high pressure gas, so it really can push the two chemicals through the field. So I think that chlorpicrin did more of the damage, but methyl bromide made the field completely covered with the fumigation. And so it controlled not only these plant diseases, but also nematodes, little worms, and weeds. And so growers widely adopted this practice starting in the late 1950s, and by the 1960s, almost everybody had adopted this practice, and the university claimed that verticillium was controlled, and then the plant breeding started focusing on other sorts of qualities. And from there, the industry just started burgeoning, like productivity increased 10, 20, 30-fold.
So you have, on the one hand, the breeding of these particular types of strawberries, and then this new chemical regime, which both killed off pathogens but also stimulated growth of the plants. Tell us about the other factors in the early days, relatively speaking, of the strawberry industry that helped create this enormously abundant strawberry production. And I'm thinking here specifically about land and about labor.
Right. So one of the things that California has that other places do not is a climate and soils really amenable to strawberry production. And so most of I mentioned that strawberries were started in the Pajaro Valley, and they were elsewhere, but then the industry increasingly converged on the coast. So what did the coast had? Well, for one, it has sandy soils, and strawberries do much better in sandy soils because they drain, and that actually helps a little bit with disease. But the other thing the coast has is the natural air conditioning of the Pacific Ocean. So those of your listeners, who are many of them, who live on the coast of California know that our summers are cool and that we get all that fog off the Pacific Ocean and the cool breezes. And so that's great for strawberry production because the strawberries think it's spring all the time. And so whereas other places that get very hot in the summer, and that's where you have three-week seasons for strawberries. That natural air conditioning of the Pacific Ocean, you could keep strawberries in the ground for 9 months. So this, you know, the climate and soils of California were a huge advantage. And that allowed breeders to breed to take advantage of those long seasons. So they started, for instance, doing two different kind of varieties. They would do what are called short day varieties, which are varieties that are bred for the winter months that don't need a lot of light. That's why they're short day varieties. And they would breed day neutral varieties that would produce throughout the summer. And so that allowed strawberries to be almost around. That allows strawberries to be in the ground nearly year round. And of course, the other huge advantage for the strawberry industry was a compliant and cheap labor force. And that, of course, has to do with California's long history of bringing in politically marginalized groups to do California's farm labor. And strawberries are very delicate, and they require attention to size and rot and firmness, and they don't all come ripe at the same time. So it requires a lot of care to pick a strawberry. So having a politically marginalized labor force with close supervision ensured that there was care. The other thing the industry landed on to keep labor costs fairly cheap is paying workers at piece rate. Some growers still do a combination of hourly wages and piece rate, but most harvesters are mainly on piece rate.
Piece rate meaning that how much you're able to pick in an hour determines your pay.
Exactly. And that has to equal minimum wage. And so that means that people that can't pick enough to make a minimum wage get laid off. And growers like to say that the workers like piece rates because they can make a lot of money, and many do make well above minimum wage, but they work crazy, crazy at crazy speeds, at backbreaking speeds. If you visit a strawberry field, you'll see workers running through the field to pick strawberries, and then they'll pick a box, and then they'll run back with the box to load it onto a truck where it's measured, to make sure they got their full allotment to get the piece rate. And a strong worker is said to pick about 9 crates an hour. So if you can picture a crate that has 12 baskets in it, they're picking 9 of those an hour, which is extraordinary.
And what do we know of the physical cost to people of doing that kind of work?
Well, you know, Seth Holmes wrote in his book, Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, much more about this than I write about, but it's lots of back and neck conditions because strawberries are grown close to the ground, so people are bent over and then they're running. Workers are also exposed to pesticides that are used on strawberries. Now, the fumigants that are really the center or the driving force of my book are not generally a problem for workers working in the field because, again, those fumigants are applied before you plant strawberries. But there are other chemicals that go on strawberries, and workers do complain about them.
Right. And of course, strawberries are regularly considered one of the dirtiest types of fruit that people consume in the United States. The Environmental Working Group yearly labels a Dirty Dozen, and strawberries are always part of that. But the fumigants, which we'll be discussing, are not actually what gets picked up in those measurements of pesticide load.
That's correct. The Environmental Working Group's Dirty Dozen is measures pesticide residue, and fumigants don't cause residue. And again, they're applied before you plant.
I'm speaking with Julie Guthman about her book, Wilted: Pathogens, Chemicals, and the Fragile Future of the Strawberry Industry. That's published by UC Press. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you've been talking about the different elements that were necessary for this highly abundant strawberry production in California. And I want to ask you how those elements have changed, but let me first ask you about land. You've talked about how the coastal climate was particularly auspicious for strawberry production. California is a state with high land values. In the earlier days of the strawberry industry, was that the case, and how has that changed over time?
Yeah, that's a really important question. So in the earlier days, when the University of California was advising growers about what to do to deal with pathogens, they'd say, just move to another piece of land. Land was abundant and cheap. At some point in the 1970s, and I don't think this has been well documented exactly how this happened, but those who own land in places like Salinas, like Pajaro, where a lot of ground fruit, like strawberries and vegetables are grown, landowners decided it was more lucrative to farm farmers than to farm themselves. And so most growers became leasers. And that remains true to this day. Now, the other thing that happened is these areas that where strawberries do so well are also attractive to suburbanites for the same reason, the cool coastal climates of the summer. And so there's been a lot of suburban development in the key strawberry-growing regions throughout the state, including Oxnard, including Salinas, including Watsonville. A little less so in Santa Maria, which is now becoming a bigger strawberry-growing region, in part because there's a lot more land. And so strawberries were kind of competing with suburban development for land. And sometimes people call the strawberries the last crop before suburbs. And strawberries get enough value that you can pay the rents increasingly demanded by landowners with strawberry revenues. Strawberries today cost more than $70,000 per acre to grow, which is a huge investment. And then the profits, I think, are variable, but there are a couple thousand profits. But strawberry land prices are calibrated to the expectation of a lucrative strawberry industry.
So at this point, it's still lucrative enough to be able to pay, but that seems to be changing?
Well, it does seem to be changing. I mean, the strawberry industry is seeing a huge shakeout, and all the elements that I talk about in my book are converging to cause this. But yeah, land values are much higher, and one of the things that's causing the problem is to deal with these plant diseases in ways where you don't rely on fumigants, which I'm sure we'll get to, means you have to try techniques that don't allow you to get that kind of money out of a piece of land. Because one of the key thing that fumigation did is it allowed growers to plant strawberries on the same block of land year after year. And so strawberry land rents were based on the expectation that growers could take out all those strawberries on that same piece of land per year. And land rents continued to kind of be calibrated to those expectations and that productivity. So if you're, let's say, rotating cover crops with strawberries as a way to manage soil disease, and you have that don't have that land and strawberry production, and you're not getting an organic premium, you can't pay that land rent.
Well, let's talk about the fate of the chemicals that have been so important and so complicated in the story of the abundant production of California strawberries. In particular, tell us about methyl bromide, which combined with tear gas was able to stimulate so much production and protect the strawberries from the pathogens in the soil. When did methyl bromide's fortunes change?
Okay, so growers have been using methyl bromide and chlorpicrin, and the main chemical is methyl bromide. They thought that did all the action, and chlorpicrin was used almost as a warning agent because apparently it stinks too. So in methyl bromide, you don't detect. So if you had a little bit of chlorpicrin in the mix and people started tearing or smelling things, they know that there was some leakage. But methyl bromide came under scrutiny as part of the Montreal Protocol on ozone-depleting substances.
In
1987. And when that treaty was first signed, methyl bromide wasn't on the chopping block, but after a few years it was. And it was supposed to be phased out.
Now tell us why. What impact does methyl bromide have on the ozone?
Well, it reaches up into the stratosphere, and so it depletes the ozone.
So this, in effect, the chemical was then tied to significant contributions to climate disruption.
For sure. So it was on the chopping block for phase out, and the strawberry industry fought hard to forestall this phase out. And they worked with the U.S. Trade Representative, and for a long time they were successful. They got what are called critical use exemptions, which are exemptions that if you can't find an economically viable alternative, you're allowed to use the chemical. And that worked for a while. Because at first they were supposed to phase it out by 2005, and then they got it forestalled, and then it was supposed to be 2015, and then it finally was phased out after that, and kind of all fruit usages were phased out by 2017. It's still used in the nurseries, and there's a story behind that that I'm happy to talk about. So methyl bromide was phased out, and for a long time, the industry kind of sat on its hands about figuring out what they were going to do without methyl bromide. Now, some growers read the tea leaves and started experimenting with other chemicals or other techniques. But for a long time, because they were getting critical use exemptions, the growers thought, we don't really have to worry about it. They're going to continue to get them for us. So they were kind of caught like in a bad place because they didn't know what they were going to do. And then along comes this other chemical called methyl iodide that had been in the works for a long time, but it was licensed. It was kind of developed by this scientist at University of Riverside and licensed by Arista Life Sciences. And some growers and some in the industry were very excited about it because they thought it could replace methyl bromide because it has a lot of qualities like methyl bromide, but it doesn't make it into the upper atmosphere, and so it's not an ozone-depleting chemical. So it stays low to the ground, which is great if you're worried about ozone depletion, but not so great if you're worried about health because that means those gaseous qualities do not dissipate. They're at ground level or near the ground, and fumigants tend to drift and are highly toxic to neighboring folks. So there's this huge battle over methyl iodide, and a lot of scientific studies show that it was more toxic than methyl bromide because methyl bromide had other toxic qualities besides its ozone depletion. It's associated with a respiratory illness, for example. But methyl iodide was not only associated with respiratory illness, but also cancer. It's even used to induce cancer in laboratory rats. Thyroid problems, possible epigenetic effects, meaning it could cause miscarriages and birth deformities, a term I don't love to use. So there's this big battle around methyl iodide, and it was interesting to me because for the first time I can recall, the kind of foodies got together with the public health community and anti-pesticide groups, environmental groups, farm worker groups, and did a massive letter writing campaign to keep the chemical from being allowed in California. And there was a lot of shenanigans by the former head of California's Department of Pesticide Regulation to get methyl iodide approved for use. This was an appointee of Governor Schwarzenegger. And they did approve it for use in kind of this 11th hour moment. But lo and behold, growers weren't adopting it. A few were experimenting with it, but growers didn't adopt it. And part of it is because the shippers and the retailers said, don't do it. We're not going to buy your strawberries and because we're really worried about consumer backlash. And some of the people that experimented with it didn't find it to be that efficacious. And so it never went anywhere, and Arista withdrew it. There was also a big lawsuit because California had the California Department of Pesticide Regulation had failed to comply with its own regulations in registering the chemical. So all that converged, and Arista Life Sciences withdrew it from the market because it was no longer economically viable for them. So growers were left with chlorpicrin, which some use solely these days, and some combine it with other chemicals. There's a chemical called telone that's more effective with nematodes and with diseases, but it's also a carcinogen, and there's restrictions on that. And because so much strawberry production is near homes and schools, there's increased restrictions on those chemicals just in terms of mitigation measures. So the restrictions have been increasing over the last few years with another administration and with another head of the Department of Pesticide Regulation. And so they're seeing more and more mitigation measures required, the most important of which are buffer zones. So it means you have to have a certain distance between where you apply the chemical and where there are other uses, including houses. There's even larger buffer zones around hard-to-evacuate sites like hospitals and schools and prisons. And so since growers are farming very close to suburbs, that really affects them too. So they can't use this chemical in parts of their field.
So has there been a noticeable change in yields after methyl bromide was phased out?
That's a really difficult question because growers complain about a lot of loss to plant disease. And one of the things that happened is these two pathogens or two diseases that had not emerged previously or had at least not been detected previously have now emerged. One's called Fusarium oxysporum, which is the same fungus responsible for Panama disease. The other one's called Macrophemina faezalina, which is even more destructive. And so growers have seen a lot of damage from these two pathogens. And yet, productivity is at an all-time high. So it's kind of unclear what's going on there. It really is.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'm joined today by Julie Guthman. She's professor of social sciences at the University of California at Santa Cruz. And we're talking about her book, Wilted, Pathogens, Chemicals, and the Fragile Future of the Strawberry Industry. And that's published by UC Press at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. Her other books include Agrarian Dreams and Weighing In. So let's talk about the other things that have changed the strawberry industry and made it much more precarious. You talked already about land, but I wanted to ask you about labor. You spoke earlier how the strawberry industry, like much of the fruit industry, is dependent on the cheap labor of skilled workers for, you know, what are these specialty crops. The growers complained to you in the course of your research of a labor shortage. Is there a labor shortage in the strawberry industry, and how do you make sense of it?
Yeah, well, you know, there's no question that crossing the border has gotten a lot more difficult. And for a while, it worked really well for the strawberry and other industries to have these tighter restrictions on the border because which started way before our current era, alas. Because when you have unauthorized workers, you can, if they complain, you can threaten deportation. So it's really worked well to have a very compliant workforce. But even before, I mean, I did a lot of this research before Trump was elected, and growers were complaining of a worker shortage. And the complaints were pretty consistent in what they said. They talked about not having a lot of acres picked. Now, that means that they maybe weren't picked throughout the entire season. They talked about workers showing up and inspecting fields to see if there was abundant fruit on the vine, because if there wasn't, they were going to go to a place which had more fruit on the vine, because if they're working on piece rates, they want to be able to pick as fast as they can. So when they see a lot of fruit in one place, they know they can do that. The growers talked to workers calling their friends on their cell phones and saying, come here, it's got great stuff. And the growers talked about workers showing up for a day and then leaving the next day. So I'm inclined to believe that that's true. I mean, we know that labor shortages are a construction, but they're a construction of a long history of how we have made agricultural labor seem unskilled, even though it's highly skilled, and low pay. And so we would have to the wage rates would have to completely change to attract the workers that President Trump, for example, would imagine might come if with a tighter border. So I'm inclined to believe it. Strawberries are also really kind of the entry level position in terms of it's hard work. And so if workers see other opportunities, they'll go to other fruits or they'll go to other crops. They'll even go to raspberries because with raspberries you can pick standing up. Or they'll go to non-agriculture. They'll go to, you know, immigrants will go to working in construction or something like that. So I'm inclined to believe it. And I do believe it's gotten a lot worse. Now, what I have a little hard time believing is when growers say that the workers are obstinate and cause trouble and aren't as compliant as they used to be, because I think it's pretty frightening for any agricultural worker to be out there these days. They're worried, and they have good reason to be worried because of the ICE raids happening in some arenas. So I don't detect a lot of compliance, but I believe that there is a labor shortage. And I was just doing some more interviews this summer for a related project, and that's that the industry complains about most. And they're also complaining about labor costs, because two things that have happened that are significant is, one is California is raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And the other thing is that for a long time, agriculture was exempt from overtime laws, and it no longer is. So their costs are, it's true, they are getting higher. And if you look at cost studies, their labor costs are a much higher percent of that $70,000 investment than they used to be.
Well, let's talk about what the future holds for the strawberry industry, because while you're saying that there's incomplete information about how yields are faring right now, looking into the future, you argue that things look precarious.
Right. Well, things look precarious because labor costs are going up. There's these new diseases that have shown up in the fields. That are not as amenable to the current menu of fumigants. Land prices are high and good land is scarce, and some of the sharper shippers are monopolizing good land and leasing it back out to the growers they like. The breeding apparatus is becoming more proprietary. Climate change is affecting the berry industry, because one of the identified causes of these novel diseases is heat. I mean, the heat stresses the berries and makes them more susceptible to an infestation of something like macrophemina. So there's a lot of things bearing down on the industry. And weirdly, prices are really low. I mean, so that's the weird thing about the productivity, because productivity somehow remains high, and that means prices are low. So all these things are bearing down, and so the alternatives to growing without fumigants are not evidently able to produce strawberries at the same scale as we have today, and are more resource intensive.
Well, let me ask you about that, because activists who are concerned about food production and the food system, many of them would imagine that organic agriculture would be a viable alternative. How does organic cultivation of strawberries compare to the kind of chemical-intensive, fumigant-intensive agriculture that you've described?
Well, one thing that's really interesting is organic means a whole lot of things in the strawberry industry. Now, that's always true, but I mean it in a much more specific way. And I don't mean that strawberry growers are cheating when they say they're organic, but I'm saying that a lot of different practices that are alternatives to fumigation fall under organic. And they range from highly integrated practices where growers are rotating strawberries with other crops and composting and cover cropping, how many of your listeners might imagine organic to be. That kind of agroecological system doesn't work when you have high land prices. It's not economically viable. But anyways, that's part of organic. Another thing that a lot of growers are experimenting with that are organic or that have some of their acreage in organic production is a technique called anaerobic soil disinfestation. And that involves taking a carbon source like rice bran or molasses and getting it in the field and injecting the fields with water and covering it with plastic. And it causes anaerobic conditions in the soil and the pathogens don't do as well. That's had mixed results in terms of efficacy. There's still a lot of studies to see at what scale it can be successful at. But that's considered organic. And then some growers are experimenting with what they call field-scale hydroponics, which means rather than planting strawberries in the ground, they're putting them in tabletops. And these are tables that are situated in the field, and they're lined with some sort of burlap or something to contain the medium. And the medium they're using is coconut coir or peat moss, something that's not fertile like soil. And then they're kind of creating hydroponic systems. So it's still taking advantage of the climate of the coast, if not the soil of the coast. But that's a super expensive undertaking. It's highly experimental. The strawberries have not been bred to grow in this material, and so some people say that they don't taste very good. We could argue about whether the other ones taste very good. and this is all very secret, so it's really hard to know how this is doing. But that's considered organic, too, because hydroponic operations are considered organic these days after a long fight in the National Organic Program. And so there's some growers who are really dedicated to organic techniques, again, that are doing integrated systems, and a lot of those are selling in direct markets, so maybe they're getting higher prices. But when you're going to the grocery store or a Safeway and you see organic strawberries, it's unlikely that those are coming from an integrated system. It's likely that they're coming from the others. And the other thing that growers are doing is, for their organic programs, is they're finding land that was not in crop production before, like let's say it's in pasture, so it doesn't have the disease load of typical strawberry land, and they'll grab that land and use it until it starts having disease, and they'll move on. So organic isn't a guarantee that you're getting a system that's going to last in the long haul.
Julie Guthman is my guest. We're talking about soil-based pathogens, chemical fumigants, and the political economy of the strawberry industry. And it seems like what you're saying and what you argue in the book, Wilted, is that whatever answers there might be for the future of the strawberry industry are not simply debates around science or ecology, that many of the constraints, many of the elements are part of a larger structural social system that the industry has evolved within, especially since World War II, but preceding that as well, and that to make changes to the ways that strawberries are produced, that there are certain constraints that we might call political economic that might be quite hard to change. Is that accurate?
For sure. I mean, the challenges are political economic and ecological and scientific. There's no question about it. But the political economic ones, for one, is the land costs. I mean, that's the one that really stands out because the alternatives that seem viable for the long run, which are more integrated systems, strawberries are a minor crop in those systems. And so you can't count on getting those high prices from strawberries relative to what you would get for broccoli, much less when you're leaving that land fallow or composting it or putting it in cover crops. And so so you can't pay for high-value strawberry land with an integrative system unless you're getting some sort of premium. But organic premiums are always subject to competition. So land costs are huge. And, you know, the role of the shippers is also an important factor here. There's been quite a bit of consolidation both among growers and among shippers. There's only a few major shippers doing business these days. And the one that everybody's heard about is, of course, Driscoll's.
Sure. Subject of a boycott.
Yeah. And Driscoll's is a very interesting company because on one hand, they've been kind of on the cutting edge of everything. I mean, they've been an aggressive company in the strawberry business since they started over 100 years ago. And, you know, they were the first to patent a berry that they thought would do well. They were the first to break off from the University of California and establish their own breeding institute. And now, you know, they claim to be doing more stuff around labor, and they have a significant research program in organics and sustainable methods. But here's the rub with Driscoll's is they don't grow any of their own strawberries. But independent growers working with Driscoll's have a really interesting arrangement. So some of them really like working with Driscoll's because Driscoll's has effectively marketed itself as a better berry. And they do put a lot of effort into their plant breeding operation. So they can get higher prices if you're a grower working with Driscoll's. But you have to pay royalties to Driscoll's, which are sizable. Driscoll's also has much higher cull rates. They want a particular shape and size. So growers that work for Driscoll's say that they're tossing about 30% of their berries. Oh. And they have to pay sales commissions, and they have to pay those boxes and all the marketing material. So Driscoll's is taking a lot of what are effectively rents from the growers without taking any of the risks.
What you've been describing is an industry which is so tightly connected to the form that agriculture has taken place, especially since the post-World War II era of these very chemical-intensive systems, many, many dimensions, of course, to the story. But one question that springs to mind in reading this and thinking about the strawberry industry and its precarity, given the chemicals that have been used, ironically, how those chemicals added to global warming and then global warming changing the climate in which strawberries are raised, and of course other changes to do with land and labor. But it brings the question to mind, should we really be producing or expecting to have produced for us strawberries all year round?
That's a great question, and it's one I get all the time. And, I'm agnostic on this. I think it's a really tough question. One thing is, you know, nutritional advice these days tells us to eat lots of fruits and vegetables. And I've had so many people from outside of California tell me, strawberries are the only fruit my kid will eat. And it's January and I'm in New York and if I have strawberries from California, they'll eat some fruit. And, you know, we got to take that seriously. So that's one piece of it. And the other piece is I think that it's the strawberry industry has brought us to this place where it's like the tip of an iceberg of an agricultural system that has gone awry, I guess we could say. But it's not all that's true of every crop. I mean, we take strawberries away and we look at the next crop and we're going to see plenty of bad. And so I don't think that the answer here is like, let's go back to like the 3-week season of strawberries. I think we have to think about how to do this better. And I think some in the industry recognize that.
Well, it leads to the obvious next question, which is this form of agriculture sustainable? I mean, not just strawberries, but beyond it. And how can it change within the confines of contemporary capitalism?
That's the big question. And it's not particularly sustainable. Strawberries are much else. And capitalism does put huge constraints on this because of land values, because of the crazy, crazy way in which workers are remunerated, because of, you know, the consolidation on and on, all the things that we all know about this. And so none of it seems particularly sustainable. And yet the kind of ways in which we can imagine something more sustainable are very hard to get to right now.
Looking into the future, do you see the kind of breakdown of this kind of agricultural model, even if there's not something poised to take its place?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of breaking down now. I mean, we are seeing growers go out of business, like a lot, in the last few years. And those who are staying in are the ones that were more innovative to begin with. And we're also seeing the shippers go out of business. I mean, Dole used to have a big strawberry operation. They're out of it right now. So it's like even big guys are losing out with strawberries right now. So it's breaking down. Some in the industry say it's fine if there's a shakeout because maybe the prices will finally go up and I can make a better living. But the bigger question of beyond this industry is I do think things are breaking it down. And these pathogens are, the canary in, or the strawberries may be the canary in the coal mine with the pathogens overtaking. And I think that's all there. But I don't know how to get from here to whatever there is in any simple way, because I just don't think we can imagine this kind of ecological ideal that'll just appear without kind of new science and without new property rights and all sorts of things.
Well, we're bracketing, if we can, for a moment, that whole aspect, that political economic aspect. But just talking about the science, one of the parts of the story that has been very interesting, is interesting, and it's not at all exclusive to strawberries, is the role of agricultural scientists in advising the industry and shaping the kinds of avenues that are followed and not others. And you mentioned the University of California and the role that it has played there. How do you see the role of agricultural scientists now when it's pretty clear there's a crisis socially but also ecologically? What sort of role are agricultural scientists playing in dealing with possible solutions?
Yeah, agricultural science is a big part of the book. And the deal is that the University of California, which is a land-grant university, has been one of many land-grant universities that is in the business of supporting growers and supporting an industry. What I call it in the book repair, based on the work of Christopher Henke. But what the university can provide is limited. So most of the university's interventions have been about increasing productivity. But when there's gluts in the market, as there always are, the university is less good at figuring out how to get rid of those gluts. And the industry has had to call on other kind of call on themselves to figure out how to market the excess strawberries. So that's one problem is that generally, university science is geared toward productivity. And to be fair, I mean, the university is very serious right now about breeding for disease resistance and recognizes the need to grow strawberries more sustainably. And not the land grants, but this anaerobic soil disinfestation, which is the technique is coming out of UC Santa Cruz. So there are university researchers that are very serious about finding more sustainable replacements for fumigation. But the other issue here, and the abiding issue, is these are ecological problems that are complex. That disinfesting or killing pathogens with fumigation was a very, very simple solution. And now that these pathogens are reemerging, and now there's a lot more recognition that boy, we need to understand soil a lot better than we do. And that soil has all sorts of microorganisms going, and maybe disinfesting soil may not be the right solution. So it means a lot more attention to how these things are integrated. And the other issue with agricultural science is people are very narrowly trained and narrowly operating. Like if you go to UC Davis and talk to scientists there, and the scientists there have been super helpful, and I'm involved with them on another project, And they're committed, but they're like, I'm a soil scientist and I focus on, this tree, or I'm a, plant pathologist and I focus on this plant. I mean, so they're very narrow, and this is a solution that needs a lot more integrated ecological science.
Let me end by asking you about those who would argue that maybe we just need to learn to live with pathogens.
Yeah, I mean, that living with is one potential solution, and I don't necessarily disagree. particularly if the problem is high productivity, then maybe letting some plants die would be okay. But the problem is it doesn't really happen on a, like, oh, everybody could take a, you know, a 10% loss, even though a lot of growers don't even want a 10% loss. But it means some growers get hit really hard. And these are, there's livelihoods at stake as well here. So it's living with is an uneven process. I think ultimately that may be what we have to do. But it won't, it's not pretty, and there will be people hurt, and ecology's hurt.
Yeah. Julie Guthman, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on your show.
Julie Guthman is the author of Wilted: Pathogens, Chemicals, and the Fragile Future of the Strawberry Industry. That's published by UC Press. Her other books include Agrarian Dreams and Weighing In, both of which we talked with her about. She teaches social sciences at UC Santa Cruz. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. We'll be right back.